In this lecture, I want to look at the history of Sparta, one of the most famous Greek city-states, but one which develops along a path completely different from the rest of Greece. Unlike every other Greek city-state, the Spartans built no monumental structures, they minted no coins, and they produced no memorable art or literature. The Greek historian Thucydides wrote that if Greece became deserted, and one day in the future someone was to come across the ruins of Sparta, they would never believe that this had been the site of one of the most powerful cities in all of Greece. What made the Spartans important was that they specialized in producing the very best warriors in all the Greek world. And they did this by developing a unique, maybe even bizarre, social system. Most of this lecture will explore the Spartan social structure and its effects. But before we can do this, I have to look briefly at how the Greeks of this time fought. In Greece, beginning around the 7th century BC, there was a fundamental change in military equipment and tactics, which would have far-reaching effects. And historians have labeled this the Hoplite Revolution, since these new sorts of soldiers were called hoplites. A hoplite was what we today would call a heavy infantryman, meaning a foot soldier who is equipped with lots of protective armor and powerful offensive weapons for hand-to-hand combat. The hoplite's most important piece of equipment was his shield. And this would have been a heavy, circular, concave shield made out of wood and bronze. And it would be a full 3 feet in diameter. The hoplite would hold this in front of his body, and it would cover him pretty much from his chin down to his knees. In addition, the hoplite had other kinds of armor, such as a bronze helmet to protect his head. And around his chest, he would wear a breastplate. This could be made of bronze as well, sometimes leather, or laminated linen. And by the way, one of my current research projects that I'm doing is reconstructing exactly this sort of linen armor. We're also testing its protective ability by shooting arrows at it. And we found that this sort of armor is surprisingly tough. It's just as effective as bronze armor, which weighs 3 times more. Then, to protect his lower legs, hoplites wore greaves. And these were sort of strips of bronze which were molded to fit the front of the leg. Then, on offense, he had a spear, which would have been 6 to 9 feet long with a bronze tip. And finally, as a weapon of last resort, he would have a 2-foot sword on a belt around his waist. This whole set of equipment was extremely expensive because it used a lot of precious bronze. And in modern terms, it might be something analogous to the investment you might make to buy a car. Along with all this equipment came a new style of fighting. Earlier in the Homeric era, combat had been a wild melee. Every man fought for himself. And warfare was really just a series of individual one-on-one duels. But with all this armor, a hoplite could not move very quickly. And he was vulnerable to being attacked from behind or the sides. From the front, though, with all his armor and his shield, against an opponent who didn't have those protections, he was nearly invulnerable. So to take advantage of this, the new strategy of warfare in the Greek world was to form a group of hoplites into a line, with each of their shields slightly overlapping that of their neighbor. And so from the front, they would present a solid wall of metal punctuated by spear points. Usually, multiple rows of hoplites would be arranged one behind the other, forming a solid mass of men. And this formation is called the phalanx. The key to success for a phalanx of hoplites is cooperation. Every man has to stand firmly in his place, because as long as no gap opens up in the phalanx, it's almost impossible to harm them. But as soon as any gap opened up, people could dash in and attack them from the vulnerable sides. So each man's life literally depended upon his neighbors staying in their place in the line. And there was thus a kind of ideology of the phalanx. And in the phalanx, every hoplite was equally valuable. every hoplite was supposed to do the same thing at the same time. And in a way, they were all equal and interchangeable. The phalanx worked best when everyone had practiced at marching and fighting together. And this then created a new emphasis on drill and discipline that had not yet been present in warfare. Incidentally, the whole hoplite revolution would be one of those forces which would kind of push the Greek cities towards a form of democracy, because now military success depended on having large numbers of people with roughly equal amounts of wealth. And this was because each soldier had to supply his own equipment. Hoplite battles themselves were brutal physical affairs, where the whole goal was to maximize the chance of killing as many of your enemy as possible. And this whole style of combat, this intensive sort of warfare, was new as well. Some historians have even argued that the Greeks had created a new model for what is sometimes called the Western way of war. And that's a style of warfare whose purpose is to bring about a decisive battle with maximal slaughter. All right, let's return now to Sparta. From the very beginning, Sparta was odd. Unlike a lot of Greek city-states, they were located fairly far inland, so they did not have easy access to the sea. Even by the standards of Greek topography, Sparta was isolated because there were steep mountains all around it. And so the early Spartans tended to keep to themselves more than other Greeks. Now, the key moment in Spartan history happened during the era of colonization. Whereas almost every other Greek state solved the problem of overpopulation by taking their extra people, putting them on boats, and sending them out to found new colonies, the Spartans alone found a different solution. Their solution was to invade the neighboring territory of Messenia, conquer it, and steal the land of its inhabitants. This key event happened around 730 BC, and it was called the First Messenian War. And this one action would irrevocably put the Spartans on a totally different track of development from all the other Greek city-states. Sparta's treatment of Messenia was also unusual. The Spartans did not move into Messenia and live there themselves. Instead, the Messenian people were reduced to the status basically of slaves. But how this worked was the Messenians were divided up among the Spartans, and each full Spartan citizen was assigned one or more Messenian farms as sort of his. The Spartans called the enslaved Messenians helots. And that's a Greek term that literally means something that you have seized or captured. These helot farms were free to live on their own, but they had to turn over half of everything they produced to their Spartan. Aside from that, though, they were left pretty much undisturbed. They could live as they wanted, marry who they wanted, raise their families, build their own houses. And that degree of I suppose freedom for a slave had the effect of making them want to regain their independence, quite naturally. And so soon enough, the helots got together and revolted, and this caused the Second Messenian War around 650 BC. So, as a result of the constant threat and worry that the helots would revolt, the Spartans become totally preoccupied with the idea that they have to maintain a very, very high level of military strength, so that when those rebellions show up, they can put them down. And eventually, the entire Spartan state becomes warped by that one obsession. And sure enough, the Messenians continue to revolt many, many more times, and that only strengthens the paranoia of the Spartans. So all of Spartan culture and society become twisted and directed towards the single aim of producing perfect hoplites, perfect warriors, in order to keep the Spartan yoke of oppression on the helots. Sparta traditionally traces its constitution back to a guy named Lycurgus, and he may well be mythical, we're not sure. But he was allegedly the reformer who established a body of laws, setting up the Spartan government. And the Spartan political system is pretty basic. At the top, they had a dual kingship. And this is, again, something odd. It means that they had two kings simultaneously who were of equal power and actually had separate royal families. The kings had to perform various ceremonial and religious stuff, but their most important function was that they served as the generals of Sparta's army. So, typically when Sparta was at war, one king would lead out the army in the field and the other would stay at home. And that way, no matter what disaster happened, they couldn't lose both kings at once. There was also a council of elders called the Gerousia. The Spartans like to name things very literally, so Gerousia literally means the old guys. And this was made up of 28 men over the age of 60, so for the ancient world they were really old, plus the two kings. They also had some elected officials, but a lot of the day-to-day power rested with the kings and the Gerousia. All right, while Sparta's political system with its dual kings was pretty unusual, what was most distinctive about Sparta, though, was its social system. And remember, this had the single goal of producing fanatical, identical, and superbly trained hoplites. I think the best way to explain the Spartan social system is to simply take you through the life of a typical Spartan citizen from his birth to his death and describe what he would have experienced. So, let's say a male Spartan child is born. What happens to him first? Well, as soon as a male child was born, the Gerousia, these old guys, would come knocking at the door. And they would say, "Give us the baby to inspect." They would examine the child, and if the child had any visible disabilities, even if he looked weak in any way, if he didn't cry loudly enough, then they would take the child away, carry it out into the woods, and leave it exposed to the elements to die. So literally, from birth, Spartan men were already being winnowed to leave only the strongest. Let's say the boy is strong, he cries loudly, he looks good, so he's accepted. Then he lives at home until the age of 7, a relatively normal early childhood. But at this point, he's taken away from home and enrolled in a communal state-run school. And in this school, the boys were divided up by age, and each age group was called a herd. And what did Spartan boys study in school? Well, they don't learn reading, they don't learn writing, but instead they spend all their time in athletic training, playing sports, doing gymnastics, and most importantly, learning military skills and practicing with weapons. Spartans also believed that a good soldier, more than anything else maybe, had to be tough. So the program of exercise, even for these young boys, was very, very rigorous, and always it was super competitive. The boys were always forced to compete against one another. They did all sorts of things to toughen them up. So, for example, they would only give each boy a single sort of blanket or cloak, and that was all the clothing he had. And even in the depths of winter, when it was cold, that's all he could wear. Spartan boys were not allowed to wear shoes, and they simply had to run barefoot over the ground, whether it was full of stones or through the snow. Spartan boys were not given beds to sleep on, but once a year they could go down to the river Eurotas, which is the river that flows by Sparta, and gather some weeds, and then they would put these down on the floor of their barracks, and that was their bed for the next year. The children were constantly pressured and forced to compete against one another in sort of combat sports like boxing and wrestling to put a sharp edge on their aggressiveness. And the boys who lost too many times or just weren't good at these things would be savagely humiliated, and everyone would make fun of them and mock them. and this seems to have often led those who repeatedly lost to end up just committing suicide. One interesting strategy was that the Spartan boys were deliberately not fed enough food to survive. Now, at first glance, this seems a little counterproductive. I mean, if you're trying to produce the strongest warriors, shouldn't you feed them a lot? But what it did do was it forced the children, in order to have enough to eat, to learn to do things like to creep out into the forest at night, where they could catch wild animals and bring them back to the dorm to eat. Or they would learn how to sneak around quietly at night and steal food from the kitchens. Now, of course, if they were caught by the teachers, they would be severely whipped. But the Spartans felt that this procedure not only made the boys immune to hardship, but it taught them skills which would be useful in warfare, such as how to move around quietly at night, how to be stealthy, how to be sneaky, and how to be resourceful and live off the land. There's a famous story about a Spartan boy and food, which I think illustrates the Spartan mentality very nicely. According to this story, one boy searching for food had snuck off to the forest, and he had managed to capture a fox alive in a snare. And he was now bringing it back to the dormitory tied up underneath his cloak when a teacher caught him. The teacher starts interrogating the boy, where were you, why were you out after dark, things like this. And while that interrogation was going on, the fox managed to get its jaws free. And underneath the boy's cloak, it began gnawing a hole into his abdomen. But with true Spartan toughness, the boy didn't let on that anything was happening, because that would reveal he had been in the forest and doing something wrong. So he ends up just going back to the dormitory, and there he bleeds to death. Well, we might view this as kind of a shocking and horrible story, but to the Spartans, this was terrific. That boy was remembered and honored for his actions. He became a hero and a role model who showed that kind of toughness that all the boys should display. They stayed in these schools until they were about 20 years old. And during the last 5 years of school, they were encouraged to form a homosexual relationship with a young adult male. And interestingly, this seems to have not been viewed so much as a sexual relationship. That was part of it, but wasn't the main focus. But rather, it was seen as a kind of a mentoring program, or we would say a big brother program. In the last year or two of their schooling, they joined something called the Krypteia. And this was the Spartan secret service or intelligence organization. And its main purpose was to spy on the Helots, and especially to try and foresee any attempts at rebellion. The Krypteia would also watch out for any individual Helot who seemed to be agitating his peers, or even to have leadership ability, or just be unusually physically strong. And then they would go have that Helot assassinated. Each year, Sparta formally declared war on Messenia. And what this did is it made it legal for any Spartan to kill any Messenian for any reason at any time. As a kind of a final exam before achieving adulthood, young men were sent out on a mission in which they were told to go to Messenia, assassinate a Helot who had been identified as a risk, and then come back. And the Spartan was sent out unarmed. He had to cross those tall mountains, survive the snow, the wild animals, live off the land, find the Helot, strangle him in the night, and then get back to Sparta. And if he was successful, then he was judged ready to become a full Spartan citizen. At that point, at the age of 20, he would join one of the men's clubs. These are called the Syssitia. These clubs consisted of usually about 15 members. And that would be the center of the young man's life for the rest of his life. He would live there, he would eat in this men's club, and he would spend most of his time practicing for war with his fellow clubmates. And when the Spartan army marched off to war, each little Syssitia comprised a unit, sort of a platoon, in the Spartan army. Now, since Spartan men were supported entirely by the labor of their helots, the males could spend all their time preparing for war and practicing military drills. And this made them completely unique among Greek city-states, because in essence, Sparta then had a professional standing army. Life in the men's club, by the way, was no more luxurious than their school life had been. The food remained very simple. Sparta is famous that in these men's club, they would serve one sort of food for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And it was a thing called Spartan black gruel. And the recipe for that is you take some little bits of pork and you mix in some blood and some vinegar, and there you go, that's what you had to eat. It also seems that they still encouraged sexual relationships between the older and the younger men in the Sicidia. And the idea was that if the guy that you were fighting next to was not just your best friend, but your lover as well, you would be less likely to run away in battle. Spartan men could not get married until, there's some debate about this, but it seems about the age of 30. And they had a very interesting wedding ritual. On her wedding night, the bride, who was about 18 to 20 years old, had her hair cut off, she was dressed in men's clothing, and she was placed in a dark room. The groom would then enter this room, he was expected to rape the girl, and then leave. So, not very romantic. If he then, after that, once they were married, wished to visit his wife, he had to sneak out of the men's club at night, since for the first 5 years, at least, of marriage, husbands and wives were forbidden to live openly together. Now, it looks like that after the age of 35, they maybe could live in their farms, sleep with their wives. But it also seems that they still had to eat their meals and spend most of their time at the men's club. And it also seems that most Spartan men seem to have just preferred to continue living there at night as well. Finally, if they survived long enough, at the age of 60, they were eligible to join the Gerousia. How about Spartan women? Well, for them, life was pretty similar. At birth, the Gerousia would come knocking at the door, just like with men, and they would inspect the young girl baby. And if the child looked weak or whatever, they would take her out in the woods and expose her. And because the Spartans were so focused on men and on warriors, it looks like a lot of healthy girl babies were exposed as well. At the age of 7, they too would go off to a state-run communal school, in this case the girls' school, where, just like the boys, there was an emphasis on physical fitness. And the reasoning here is that the Spartans figured that they wanted the strongest, most physically fit mothers because these would produce the strongest, most physically fit sons. Like the boys, Spartan girls also exercised nude, which the other Greek states thought was really weird. At the age of about 18 or 20, though, instead of entering the secret service, Spartan girls then would be assigned to a husband and would be married to him in that ceremony that I've previously described. Now, the life of a Spartan woman may not sound all that appealing by modern standards, but oddly enough, in some ways, Spartan women actually had more freedom and more power than women in any other Greek city-state. And in most Greek city-states, women, especially upper-class ones, were almost entirely confined to the house. So they could never go out, they could never go out alone, and they were always under the supervision of men. But think about Sparta. In Sparta, girls and women could roam around outside, and most importantly, as adults, who's running the farms? It's probably the women. They're the only ones who had the time to do that, because the men were spending all their time at their men's club. So Spartan women actually had a lot of independence and responsibility. And at least within the world of the farm, they were the decision makers. Now, maybe because so many girls were exposed at birth, Sparta suffered from a gender imbalance. there was a shortage of women. And the Spartan solution to this was often they would have one woman married to multiple husbands. And what they most preferred of all is if they could get a set of brothers who would share one woman as their sort of communal wife. Now, since the goal of Spartan society was to produce tough, identical warriors, hoplites, the Spartans disapproved of luxury and even just commerce in general. Sparta did not conduct trade with other cities. Spartans were forbidden individually to possess gold or silver. And alone, among the Greek city-states, Sparta did not mint coins. If you had to carry out some sort of a major economic transaction, they would use these big, long iron rods as a form of currency. Sparta also, with its total focus on warfare, produced almost no literature, there's no Spartan plays, and very, very little art. And we only know of one Spartan poet, a guy named Tyrtaeus. But what do you think his poems are about? They are almost exclusively about how wonderful war is and how terrific it is to get killed fighting for your country. Let me give you a sample of one of his poems. Tyrtaeus writes, "The man who loses his life falling in the front lines, pierced through the chest and the armor and the shield with many wounds, brings glory to his city, to his fellow soldiers, and to his father. And everyone mourns for him. His glory and his name will never fade from memory, but he will become immortal, even though he lies beneath the ground. This is the goal that every man should have in life, and never cease from striving in war." Spartan mothers were also famous for encouraging their sons to sacrifice themselves for the state. And one story often told about Spartan mothers is that they would tell their sons as they set off for war to come back either with their shield or upon it. And this is because the very first thing that soldiers would do when they were defeated in a battle was throw away their heavy shields so that they could run faster. And dead soldiers were often carried back on their shield. So the Spartan mothers were basically saying, either come back victorious or die trying. By the way, not all Greeks shared the Spartan dedication to victory or death. One soldier named Archilochos from the state of Thasos wrote a poem in which he proudly admits that he threw away his shield and ran away from the battlefield. He says, "A Thracian now holds aloft my shield, which I abandoned undamaged. So what? I got away safely. Who cares about the shield? I can buy another one just as good." So that's a different philosophy from Sparta. In keeping with their devotion to the idea of simplicity, Sparta built no large, impressive public buildings at all. And this is why Thucydides said that no one would be able to tell in the future that Sparta was so powerful by looking at the ruins of the city. And if you go to Sparta today, there's really nothing there. It's just a grassy field. The only hint of ostentation in Spartan society was that both Spartan men and women wore their hair long. In other states, men usually cut their hair short. And before they went into battle, Spartan warriors would ritually comb one another's long hair, rub perfume into it, and then tie it up so that an enemy couldn't grab a hold of it. Since the perfect hoplite was identical and really interchangeable with all the others in the phalanx, Spartan society was set up so as to stress the group entirely over the individual. And the Spartans took pride in this. The term they had for themselves was the homoioi, which literally translates the equals. The attitude of the other Greek states towards Sparta was really a mixture of puzzlement, admiration, and really fear. They thought the Spartans were really weird, they were aberrant, but nobody could deny that the system worked in turning out fearsome warriors. Spartans had the reputation of being fanatics, of being brave, but they also were seen as a little bit uncreative, especially compared to Athens, and maybe even a little bit stupid. And culturally sophisticated states such as Athens saw them as sort of dangerous but uncultivated country bumpkins. So, the Spartan system worked in achieving its one goal. It produced the perfect warrior. But there was a fatal flaw in this system. Have you figured out yet what that flaw was? The great failure of the Spartan system was that it simply didn't take account of human biology. By exposing so many babies at birth, by keeping men and women separate, by not allowing marriage until late in life, the Spartan system simply failed to reproduce itself. They didn't produce enough Spartan citizens. And as time went on, the numbers of Spartan citizens steadily declined. So at the beginning of Spartan history, they could field an army of several thousand hoplites. But towards the end, several hundred years later, they could barely scrape together a couple hundred. And that flaw wouldn't become apparent for a while. And for centuries, the Spartans did manage to enjoy their special status as the ultimate warriors of ancient Greece. Thank you.